Please be advised that this serving of AIDS, the Lost Voices, may cause offense or upset, as...
We read newspaper articles from the 1980s and 90s that shares detail around death. Anyone affected by these articles should reach out to the Samaritans free on 116 123.
AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS, the Lost Voices, with your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Gloria.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s, and noughties.
Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's do it. Hey.
Oh, listen, everybody, it's Gloria. Hello.
Hello.
She's back.
It's been a while.
She's given... Don't keep giving me evils. I've just been so busy. We had Halloween, then we had Bonfire Night here in the UK. That's traditionally known as Guy Fawkes Night.
Uh-huh.
Then you guys had Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Then I had to deal with making a claim to an employment tribunal for HIV-related discrimination, harassment, and victimization. So, you know, that took up a lot of my time. And then World AIDS Day, which was very poignant and significant. And now the run-up to Christmas and New Year.
So busy, yet you still sent me a shitload of voice notes.
Do you know, it's just, I send them because they're so much easier and I feel so much faster than typing,
Yeah, but they go on and on and on.
And on and on.
Have you heard yourself?
No, I don't listen to them back. I mean, I haven't got that much time. Well, occasionally I do.
Let's take a listen.
Hello, I'm sending a voice note because I can't spell camaraderie, but, you know, not even my phone knows how to spell camaraderie. Oh, actually, maybe it's C-A because I was putting C-O-N. I think I was being a bit posh, like camaraderie. Oh my gosh, I didn't have you down as a dogger. She's in the woods dogging. Oi, oi, custard chucker. I just made my own look. God, I'm absolutely starving, so I've just had 6 inches. Bit cheesy, but very nice indeed. Oh, anyway, cup of tea. Oh, poor John ain't going dogging anytime soon.
Sit back, just relax, just for a few seconds.
Just relax. I've heard that before in a lay-by.
He said he has to tell him what to do.
What's wrong with that? I mean, I'm very informative and I'm letting you know how my day is going. I mean, I can't help it, you know, being so interesting. I've got an interesting life. What can I say?
Talking of interesting, truly great work on the Michelle Lupo episodes.
Well, his name is Michele, not Michelle. But thank you very much because, you know, it was just a case of he came up in the newspaper archives as a person with AIDS. I wasn't searching for AIDS murder or AIDS murderer, just AIDS.
Yeah.
And he popped up. And when I read his story... And then obviously got so engrossed in wanting to learn the backstory, you know, of the victims, the people that had their lives so cruelly ended by this horrible, horrendous man. And and ensuring that the story was told as accurately as possible and not misleading and not with misinformation that was seriously sensationalized or glamorized.
No, you both did a great job.
Oh, thank you.
Right. Shall we get started?
Right, let's go.
The first story from the newspaper archives comes from the Manchester Evening News on October 1st, 1991. And the headline reads, The House of Horrors.
With the strapline, Dad finds girl dead and wife knifed. And the article reads, A horrified father found his little blonde daughter murdered today.
That is sad.
9-year-old Emma Poyser was lying dead in bed at her terraced home in Schofield Street, Radcliffe. Her mother, 28-year-old Angela Poyser, was found alive in her own bedroom with stab wounds to her chest and with her wrists slashed. She was taken by ambulance to Bury General Hospital, where she was having emergency surgery today. Emma's dad, postman Andrew Poyser, stumbled on the scene of horror when he arrived home from working a night shift early today.
Mr. Poyser was later at Whitefield Police Station, where he was helping detectives as they tried to investigate the background to the tragedy. He is not connected with Emma's death or his wife's injuries in any way. Detectives found letters in the house, which were being studied closely later today for any further clues.
Police sealed off Schofield Street and its back alley, and a Home Office pathologist was called to the house. A post-mortem examination was still going on this afternoon to establish just how Emma died. There were no clear signs of injury, and one theory police were considering was that Emma might have been killed by a drug overdose. A number of tablets were found in the house. Detectives were also trying to piece together the events leading up to her tragic death. They were understood to be treating her death as murder, and a spokesman said, quote, "There has been a terrible tragedy and we're making further inquiries."
Next door neighbor, Karen Bridge, said Mrs. Poyser didn't look well recently. Emma was a lovely child who played like any other kitty in the street with her pals. I'm terribly shocked. Emma went to nearby Radcliffe Hall Junior School, where Headmaster Peter Smith said, "This is a terrible shock. Emma was a lovely, likable child. What more can I say?" What an incredibly sad story. Do we learn what exactly happened?
Yes, and although press coverage was thin, so thin that the next article again in the Manchester Evening News is from the court hearing of the 27th of February 1992.
Really?
And the newspaper runs with the strapline, "Court hears of hidden mental torment that destroyed a loving family." And the headline reads, "AIDS fear drove a mother to kill." And the article states, "A mother who thought she was dying of AIDS drugged and drowned her 9-year-old daughter because she couldn't bear to leave her behind. But Angela Poyser, 29, had taken 3 AIDS tests which proved negative, a court was told today."
Thought she was dying of AIDS? So she didn't have a confirmed diagnosis?
No, and she's had 3 tests and she's tested negative. So I think it's pretty conclusive that she's not with a HIV/AIDS diagnosis.
Yeah. Taking the life of a child is so senseless, but this just, it just makes, I don't know, it makes no sense.
I know what you mean. There is never any justification in the taking of a child's life, especially your own. Hmm. And the motive behind this act said to be because the mother thought she, herself, quote, thought she was dying from AIDS.
That's sad.
So ended her daughter's life because she, the mother, couldn't bear the thought of leaving her daughter behind. It's just awful. And the article continues, "Mrs. Poyser gave her blonde daughter Emma antidepressant tablets to make her sleep. She took her out of her bed and put her in the bath and drowned her. Then she lovingly dried Emma's body and put her back to bed. Her husband Andrew arrived at their home in Schofield Street, Radcliffe, to find tablets scattered around the kitchen, which was daubed in blood. He followed the trail of blood upstairs and found his wife in bed. She had slashed both her wrists, stabbed herself in the chest, and left a suicide note. She was semi-conscious, said Mr. Charles Garside, prosecuting, but told her husband, quote, 'I've killed Emma,'" end quote. Mr. Poyser, a postman, dashed to her bedroom, where he found her body.
Mrs. Poyser pleaded guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. The judge, Mr. Justice Moreland, ordered her to be detained under the Mental Health Act in the secure unit at Prestwich Hospital without limit of time. Mr. Garside said that the family were happy and united until Mrs. Poyser's mental health began to deteriorate.
In 1989, she had attempted suicide, and at the beginning of last year, she became convinced that she had AIDS. Mr. Garside said, quote, "She believed she had contracted AIDS during a holiday in Jamaica in 1988. There is no evidence that anything she did on that holiday could have caused her to catch that disease. She has had a total of 3 negative tests, and she has definitely not got AIDS, but nothing can shake her belief," end quote.
Mr. Roderick Karras, QC, representing Mrs. Poyser, said the seeds of a personality disorder had been sown in childhood. While regarded as a happy and bubbling blonde, she had always harbored feelings of insecurity.
Mr. Karras said she had clearly tried to kill herself and, while under treatment following Emma's death, had hoarded medicines with a view to taking an overdose.
That is sad.
Absolutely. You know, it's incredibly sad. And I think as well, I mean, I don't know about anybody else listening, but it's quite a bizarre feeling to start having at least a smidgen of sympathy for Mrs. Poyser, given she's in court because she's not only killed another human being, not only that human being was a child, but this is her own daughter, her own 9-year-old daughter. And it's quite a bizarre feeling to have, as I say, a smidgen of sympathy for this woman. But then I think you have to ask, is this, in the legal sense, in the courtroom, is this just not the job of the defence?
I thought that.
To advise her to plea diminished responsibility.
Uh-huh.
But I think if you think back to 1991, mental health, or in this case, the claim of, quote, diminished responsibility, was viewed with incredible suspicion by the courts and was often a plea that people would use to avoid acknowledging their crime and avoid the appropriate punishment. But I think here, The courts accepting her plea of diminished responsibility are satisfied that it's supported with evidence, which, you know, we've heard glimpses of here in the press report. And as you say, just makes this an incredibly sad story all round. Incredibly sad.
This next story is as recent as 2016, where the BBC on the 18th of April 2016 run the headline, Milton Keynes Flat Fire. Ashley Gillard's partner admits killing him. And the article reads,
a man has admitted killing his partner and then setting fire to his flat upon hearing his victim was HIV positive.
That's awful.
Hairdresser Ashley Gillard, 31, was discovered after the blaze in the third floor property in Wolverton, Milton Keynes, on the 8th of June 2015.
Okay.
Thomas White, 26, pleaded guilty to manslaughter by gross negligence. Luton Crown Court heard White, quote, flew into a rage, end quote, before returning to the flat several days later in an attempt to destroy any evidence of the killing.
White, of Bibbury Close in Wellingboro, was originally charged with murder, but prosecutors have accepted his plea to the lesser charge. The court heard the pair had been taking illegal drugs, including GHB, and Mr. Gillard had probably died on June 5th.
A post-mortem examination could not identify a definitive cause of death, but it confirmed Mr. Gillard was dead before the fire started. Graham Smith, prosecuting counsel, said the killing happened after Mr. Gillard told White he had HIV.
Oh, man.
Quote, the defendant was furious and got into a rage and turned the flat upside down, trying to find medications that would confirm what he had been told, said Mr. Smith. He, White, was later to tell his brother that he knew his friend, Ashley Gillard, needed medical attention, but he did not help him and put a duvet over him to shut him up. Quote, he said at the moment he hated him and wished him gone.
In the days between the killing and the fire, the prosecution said White had stolen cars and a forklift truck and was filmed by CCTV cameras buying petrol to start the fire. The Riverside flat in Trevithick Court, where Mr. Gillard's body was found, had had its door barricaded.
White also pleaded guilty to 10 other charges, including arson, being reckless as to whether life would be endangered, theft, fraud, and possession of Class B and C drugs. He will be sentenced at a later date.
Oh, the question I have is, how did they go from a murder charge to manslaughter?
Good question. Now, I'm not a legal professional by any means, and I had to look this up to try and make sense of it, so I'll try and explain what I found.
Okay.
But given illegal drugs were taken by both the men, and sadly, one of the two, Ashley, has a reaction that turns out to be fatal, White cannot be accused of murder.
That's interesting.
Now, the Crown Prosecution Service website states, quote, the offence of gross negligence manslaughter is committed where the death is a result of a grossly negligent, through otherwise lawful, act or omission on the part of the defendant here being White.
Yeah.
And we'll get to hear later from White's own QC, who told the court, quote, Ashley Gillard died not by the commission of an offence, but by the omission to act when Ashley was in very vulnerable circumstances caused by the toxicity, not only by the drugs, but a further drug he had been taking. Now, again, I'm not a legal professional, and given the language that surrounds law, I had to search what the definition of, quote, omission to act, end quote, meant. And basically, it means a failure to act. So, piecing it all together, White accepts a charge of manslaughter of gross negligence, given he failed to act when Ashley started to have a fit, a seizure,
okay,
as a result of illegal drugs that they had taken.
Yeah.
And he chose not to either assist physically or, at the very least, call an ambulance, which then results in Ashley sadly passing away.
And White claims he didn't assist given Ashley had told him he was living with HIV.
Yeah, it seems so, from what we've heard so far in the testimony from Carr and from Thomas White's own mouth, is that Ashley had told him that he was HIV positive. And it does seem to be that they've only been going out or having casual sex and taking drugs together for a few weeks. It's not like it's long-term relationship. So how it came up, we don't find out how the topic came up. But the sad thing is here, although not confirmed by the court, is that we heard from that quote earlier, the defendant Sir Thomas White, was furious and got into a rage and turned the flat upside down, trying to find medications that would confirm what he had been told, which may indicate that the medications that Thomas White was looking for were Ashley's HIV medications, indicating that at the time Ashley was on effective treatment. And if Ashley was responding well and adhering to his HIV medication, that Ashley could possibly have been U equals U.
Yeah.
Undetectable equals untransmittable. So there was no danger to White. There was no threat if Ashley's medications were suppressing his viral load to such sore levels.
Good point.
That Ashley couldn't pass it on through unprotected sex.
Yeah.
So it's incredibly sad.
Perhaps indicating White was not entirely, I say with caution, worried about being or having been at risk of contracting HIV from Ashley, but perhaps the feeling of having been deceived.
And really kind of Thomas White never really gives any firm confirmation as to what did he feel at the time. As you say, did he feel perhaps somewhat deceived, even though they'd been only kind of engaging in casual sex for a few weeks? Were they hoping for something to, you know, more long term to come out of it? Or was this the moment where Ashley felt that he could tell Thomas that he was HIV positive in the hope that it would be the decider? Either he'll panic and just leave, or he'll stay because he understands U equals U and, you know, HIV is not transmissible in when you're engaged in unprotected sex if you're on effective HIV medications. But it is kind of alluded to slightly in the court proceedings that Thomas White did slightly panic that he'd been infected with the virus, or he had a worry that he was going to be infected with the virus. And I think perhaps the detail in that quote that we just read that was given to the court, where Thomas White is turning the flat upside down looking for these medications, perhaps might indicate that Ashley has said to him, don't panic, don't stress, I'm on medications, I'm U equals U, so there's nothing for you to worry about, you shouldn't be concerned, you're not going to be affected.
Yeah.
Thomas White, then it sounds as though he's then looking for these medications. Well, show me these medications. Where are these medications? So that perhaps might indicate that that was his fear, and he's looking for those medications to try and calm that fear. Okay, we've got these medications. I can Google them. What do they do? How effective they are? So that might indicate that Thomas White did genuinely have a worry that he'd somehow contracted the virus or would contract the virus.
Good point.
And needed to see these medications to perhaps understand that it was a manageable condition. And I know sharing your status with a partner or potential new partner is a dilemma for many people living with HIV, given, as this case shows, understanding new and effective treatments haven't been pushed enough. And I have said it before, but the UK government has not made any public campaign to update the nation on HIV and AIDS, especially the message around U equals U, since their AIDS tombstone of 1987. So how do you expect the public to react when their everlasting memory at the moment, for those that are old enough, and even young people actually that have seen it on YouTube, is of the doom and gloom of the tombstone falling down and a bouquet of flowers thrown onto the headstone. Death, AIDS and death, that's it.
And on the same day, April 19th, 2016, the Daily Mirror reported the story with a bit more insight into what was said within the courtroom, where they state,
the defendant, Sir Thomas White, was barely audible when he delivered 11 guilty admissions in regards to the death of the 31-year-old hairdresser. Prosecutor Graham Smith said, quote, Mr. Gillard's body was discovered by firefighters after searching his rented property after the fire had been extinguished, and one of the firefighters felt something against his foot. He crouched down and shined his torch, and there he discovered Ashley's body.
Oh,
he was face up on the bed with his arms crossed over his stomach area. There were aerosol cans around him, which made officers fear the death may be suspicious. The chest of drawers pushed up against the door, the safety chain put on, and disabling the smoke alarm were all moves which had been put in place to delay those wishing to extinguish the fire. And the court goes on to hear that Thomas White, having doused the cushions and curtains with petrol inside the flat, he starts the fire and then, having put the chain on the door and the chest of drawers up against it, makes his own escape from the flat by a rope off the balcony, some 80 feet from the third floor to the ground.
And the prosecution is reported as saying he, White, was later to tell his brother that he knew his friend needed medical attention, but he did not help him and put a duvet over him to shut him up. He said at that moment, he hated him and wished him gone.
Oh, just awful.
It doesn't sound good, does it?
And the Milton Keynes Citizen newspaper also reported detail from the proceedings where they state, he, White, went to his mother's home and confessed to his brother and later repeated his account to his mother and then his father, who lived nearby. He said he wanted to pack a case and leave the country, but his brother had alerted police who arrested him at the house.
Prosecutor Mr. Smith said, this is a very, very serious gross negligence case. He could have acted to get help, and he did not. He knew the man had ingested a lot of drugs and was vulnerable, and at the time he wished him gone.
And in the same article, we hear from Amjad Malik QC, the defense barrister representing Thomas White, who is reported as telling the court, quote, Ashley Gillard died not by the commission of an offence, but by the admission to act when Ashley was in very vulnerable circumstances, caused by the toxicity not only of the drugs, but a further drug he had been taking for erectile dysfunctional problems. The barrister said the news that Mr. Gillard was HIV was a, quote, massively provocative piece of information, end quote, for Thomas White, who had been having sex with him for weeks and months, quote, he failed to act because of anger. He didn't want him to die, said Mr. Malik.
Judge Richard Foster confirmed he would adjourn sentencing for 3 weeks to allow a senior probation officer to carry out an assessment.
Then, on the 9th of June 2016, Thomas White was sentenced, and the Sun newspaper quoted Judge Richard Foster, who passed sentence, where he stated, you and Ashley Gillard engaged in sexual activity during the course of which Ashley was tied up. He had taken two types of drugs, methadone and GHB. When the police came to arrest you a few days later, what you had to say was captured by body-worn audio and visual recorders. From this, it became clear as to what had actually happened. Ashley Gillard had told you he was HIV positive. Whilst he was tied up, he had a fit, probably induced by the drugs. You told officers, I just sat there and watched him.
I just can't get my head around how or why you would sit and watch someone in serious distress and then see them pass and do nothing.
I can't wrap my head around it either. And as we heard, the reason for doing so was because he'd learned from Ashley himself was HIV positive,
yeah,
and from the sounds of it, on effective treatment. So it makes it even more sad.
The only thing that confuses me is the timing of Ashley sharing his HIV status with White.
Yeah, and me as well. But I think that Ashley has told him in this moment, or either just before they've taken these drugs, then they're engaging in sexual intercourse at the same time. And as we heard from the judge, that Ashley is tied up. And I can't believe, unless it was the drugs, that Ashley would tell somebody or share his HIV status with somebody he's only known for a few weeks or been engaged in with for a few weeks, that he's HIV positive. If you're tied up, then you're even more vulnerable if, as this case proved, you get an adverse reaction to that information. But the Sun newspaper does quote the judge in their article where they state, quote, the judge then said White had told the officers, quote, I didn't untie him because he was fitting and because he told me he'd got HIV.
But did Ashley tell White in that moment or prior?
Yeah, it's not clear, is it? Except that at the court hearing, as we heard earlier, that Thomas White had turned the flat upside down looking for Ashley's HIV medication. So I think it's fair to assume Ashley disclosed his HIV status to Thomas White in or around that moment.
Ah.
And the court goes on to hear Thomas White, who was quoted as telling police, quote, I just thought, fuck you kind of thing, and I didn't really think about
That's
it.
That's awful.
I should have tried to help him, end quote. Then the judge said when Ashley suffered his fit, Thomas White had only thought of himself and was angry because he may have been infected with the virus. Mm.
Infected with the virus.
We just spoke about this a few moments ago, and I think the judge is alluding to White's irrational fear of being infected just because Ashley was HIV positive and they're obviously having unprotected sex. And the fact we heard White was looking for Ashley's HIV medication to me indicates Ashley was on effective treatment, as I said earlier, and most likely not at all infectious.
I agree.
And I only say likely because it's not clear if Ashley was adhering to his medication.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure he was,
yeah,
but with drug taking, even if it's occasional use and perhaps even rare, may have interfered with his adherence to his medication.
Yeah.
But if he's got medication there, I'm assuming he's taking it because it was effective.
Uh-huh.
But really, this would have been a good opportunity for the press to perhaps highlight that White's fear was irrational, given, yes, Ashley is HIV positive, but he's on effective treatment and poses no risk. Even in 2016, they knew of U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable.
Mm.
But so it would have been a good opportunity for the press to kind of vilify Thomas White, which is what the press are always good at, you know, vilifying the baddie even more.
Yeah.
By saying, you know, well, White did this, but still his fear was so irrational because, you know, Ashley wasn't infectious, he was on medication. And
uh-huh.
that would have been a good way for the press to vilify Thomas White, which, as I say, they're very good at doing.
Yeah.
Whilst letting their readers know that Ashley wasn't this 1980s plague on legs, so to speak. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, as if the press would write that.
Oh, I know. maybe one day the press will drag its sorry ass out of the 1980s. And the article continues to quote the judge while addressing White in court, where the judge is quoted as stating, "You intentionally did nothing to help a fellow human being in what was a life-threatening situation."
Exactly. I just can't get my head around why you just sit and watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's very cold, isn't it? It's very detached.
Exactly.
Anyhow, the article goes on to state, "White admitted 3 counts of theft relating to a stolen generator on June the 5th, a stolen iPhone and clothes between June the 6th and 8th, and stolen clothes, shoes, electrical charging cables, toiletries, jewellery, laptops and an iPad between the same dates."
Wow.
He admitted a further arson charge relating to damage to a Peugeot vehicle on June the 8th. He was charged with 1 count of fraud relating to the use of a credit card on the same day and possessing a Class B and Class C drug on June the 9th. All in addition to the charge of manslaughter by gross negligence, given the prosecution agreed to go with the lesser charge than that of murder.
Thomas White, 26, was sentenced where the Milton Keynes Citizen newspaper concluded in their article on June 9, 2016. White was given an extended sentence because of the risk he posed to the public by committing further serious offenses. He was given an extended sentence of 13 years and 9 months.
White was told the custody element of the sentence was 9 years and 9 months, and the period he would be on license following his release would be 4 years.
No sentence or punishment could ever bring Ashley back, but I guess some form of justice, as much as the UK legal system allows, is better than nothing.
It is, but I think it comes down to that question of that, yeah, the judge has imposed an extended sentence here, but I suppose there's always that question of, you know, is this sentence really truly reflective of the loss of someone's life?
Yeah.
And I mean, we must stress here that there wasn't a murder charge. This is manslaughter of gross negligence. It's not murder.
Yeah.
And although it's no consolation whatsoever and perhaps no interest to the family what Thomas White said or thinks, but he did concede to the police when he said, well, I should have tried to help him. The sad thing is, for Thomas White, he's got to live with knowing that he could have helped
Exactly.
Ashley, even if it had been rolling him into the recovery position
Yeah.
and calling an ambulance. You know, he potentially could have been saved. And Thomas is going to have that image in his mind for the rest of his life. But it's hard to make sense of such tragic events that only came about through Ashley disclosing to his boyfriend, whether it was casual or they were looking to go into something more long term, that he was HIV positive. It's incredibly sad.
Hmm.
And I know for people living with HIV today who worry about when to disclose during the dating process, it's still a question that gets asked given the long history of the stigma around HIV and the more widely now talked about self-stigma that essentially comes off the back of the stigma of old.
So when is a good time to disclose?
Well, there's probably two things around when is the right time to disclose. And the first one is going to be, you really need to check out the law in your country or the land that you live.
Ah.
Because in the United Kingdom, I know that there's two different laws around HIV disclosure between England and Scotland. So first of all, check out the law where you live because, you know, it's probably not going to be the same as everywhere else. And secondly, from the more personal perspective, I think only they will know if the time is right and if they're ready for the rejection, say, or perhaps even equipped to answer any questions that the person you're disclosing to is going to have, and to be ready to educate around U equals U, undetectable equals untransmissible. And two other pieces of advice that I've heard a lot is that one is the way that you disclose to someone. And I should know, being a HIV negative person, having somebody disclosing their HIV status to me, is that you need to do it in a very kind of upbeat and optimistic way. Don't do the whole serious sitting down, you know, I've got something to tell you, and, you know, if it's all doom and gloom, it's going to be really bad news. You need to do it in a very kind of upbeat and optimistic way. And I think almost in that thing of where you almost try to brush over it as quickly as possible. I've mentioned it. Here's the fact. There you go. That's it. I mean, you know, if somebody has got more questions, then obviously you'd be ready to answer them. Yeah. But I think it needs to be that. It doesn't need to be this long, drawn out, you know, 20-minute sit-down chat where it's all very serious. And the second piece of advice that I've heard frequently is that if you're going to disclose to somebody, do it in a public place. Because I think if there is going to be an adverse reaction where perhaps somebody's going to get verbal or physical or be very upset, then at least there is an opportunity for a member of the public to intervene. But it's mad, though, in 2024 that us living with HIV have to do a risk assessment around disclosing our HIV status, when it should really be normalised, or the rhetoric around the condition should be normalised. And it's, and again, I know I'm going to be on my soapbox, but again, it comes down to the UK government still refuses to update the nation with a national campaign since the one they spewed out in 1987 of the falling tombstone, the doom and gloom, the dry ice, the dark images, you know, the bouquet of flowers, the funeral lilies being thrown onto the tombstone. If a company can bang out every 2 minutes an advert for shingles, I really don't understand why an update on the 1987 tombstone with the message of you equals you, people are not infectious anymore, you don't need to bleach your cups, you don't need to bleach your toilet seats, that's really old rhetoric, you know, we've had it, it's a sin.
Yeah.
This is the message, guys, people can live with it, it's not transmissible when someone's on effective treatment. I don't understand why that's so difficult. Why is it so hard?
But ultimately, if the person does respond badly, then they're not the right person for you.
Oh, exactly. Why would you want to enter into a relationship with someone who responds negatively?
Yeah.
Excuse the pun. Yes, be inquisitive, ask questions, ask if you equals you is real. But honestly, if someone reacts badly, then they're really doing you a favour. And so I'd argue, don't look at a rejection as an entirely bad thing. You know, you've been saved.
That's an interesting point.
You know, that's not the kind of person you want in your life. So job done, kaput.
And you found an article that shared that Thomas White had been in trouble before.
That's right. Ahead of Thomas White's sentencing, the Northamptonshire Telegraph reported on the 21st of April 2016 the following. A 26-year-old Wellingborough man who has admitted the manslaughter of a hairdresser was ordered by a judge to stay out of trouble less than a month before the killing, the Northants Telegraph can reveal. Thomas White of Bidbury Close, Wellingborough, was given a deferred sentence in May last year after he admitted stealing £42,000 worth of property from a house in Milton Malsaw. Despite the fact that he could have imposed a custodial sentence, His Honour, Judge Rupert Mayo, took the step of delaying his sentence for 6 months to give White a chance to prove the crime was a one-off. Judge Mayo told White he would give him a suspended prison sentence if he, quote, kept out of trouble, did not take drugs, worked with a well-being team, remained in employment, and worked as hard as he could to compensate the victim, end quote. However, Luton Crown Court heard this week that White was responsible for the death of 31-year-old hairdresser Ashley Gillard less than a month after he was given the deferred sentence. The victim of White's burglary had also been a previous boyfriend, and White used his knowledge of how to disable the alarm code to steal goods, including a diamond watch worth £30,000. The court heard that White claimed he had, quote, no recollection, end quote, of the burglary, as he had consumed a large amount of alcohol and drugs. The court heard he went to the address with another man he had met on social media, who then booked a hotel room for them after the incident. Judge Mayo was persuaded not to send White to prison last year after reading, quote, hugely positive, end quote, references from his manager at Pizza Express in Milton Keynes, and his mother that showed his crime was, quote, out of character, end quote. The Sentencing Council states deferred sentences are used in a small group of cases close to the community or custodial sentence threshold. The guidance states the court should also ensure that the offender, quote, understands the consequences of failure to comply with the court's wishes during the deferment period, end quote. It goes on to state, quote, if the offender fails to comply with any requirement imposed in connection with the deferment or commits another offence, he or she can be brought back to court before the end of the deferment period and the court can proceed to sentence, end quote.
It's never helpful to wonder what if, but...
I essentially agree with you. It's never helpful to do the whole what ifs, but I don't think there's any escaping here that if Judge Mayo hadn't have deferred his sentence, then Thomas White may have not have crossed Ashley's path. I think it is as simple as that. At the end of the day, if Thomas White hadn't stolen a lawnmower from someone's garden shed and gone, oh, okay, this is his first time that he's committed a crime, let's defer it, give him 6 months to prove himself. Mm. These were thefts in excess of, the reports say, £40,000. Like, you know, that's not small money. For me, it just stinks. And I think the British population, I think we've come to learn over the last few months, if not the last couple of years, that when people do crimes, we want to see them punished.
Yeah.
You know, they should face justice. And why did it take the loss of Ashley's life here for Thomas White, who clearly was on the wrong path? I won't particularly say that he's a wrong'un, but was clearly on the wrong path. And I can't help but think that this was fueled by drugs and alcohol, which is not an excuse, but still. I think you've really got to hope that prison serves him well and that he perhaps has, well, he's got quite a long time to reflect on what he did or what he didn't do, essentially. And as much as we're talking about a sentence for Thomas, this is a life sentence for the family because after sentencing, they issued a statement which read, "We will never truly know what happened to Ashley on that day. It's something that will haunt us forever. We now begin our life sentence without Ashley. A huge thank you to the police, family, friends, Ashley's friends, our employers and work colleagues for your support throughout this horrific nightmare and for your continued support."
All of the actual newspaper articles mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes. If you've enjoyed listening to AIDS, The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share, as in the link, not as in
do you believe in life after love? Oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.